Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. That is myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, rock chip writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are you this fine day? I have to say that I'm going into a bit of a depression because I've been quite lucky over the last two or three weeks. It's been dull and grey and rainwater's been pouring down on my plants in my garden, and that's the sort of weather I like. But I'm afraid this is now the start of a two-week heat wave, so you're going to find me a bit grouchy over the next couple of weeks, Miss Jones.
Oh, I think I can handle it, Mike.
Yeah, I'm sure you can.
You know, it could be worse. You could be in Southern California right now.
Yeah, what's that song? And it never rains in California.
Yeah, well, I mean, God, the weather. They've said that the temperatures will be hitting an all-time high of the early 50s. Can you believe it?
I know. It's the highest temperatures in the world. I'm trying to figure that song. And it's never gonna rain in California or something like that. I don't know.
It never rains in Southern California, I think it is. I can't remember who did it. But Greg Milam on Sky News last night was saying that within 10 years, Southern California, especially places like Palm Springs, will be uninhabitable by humans.
I totally agree. There's parts of Australia which are uninhabitable. I've flown over parts of Australia in a small plane where white people, I'm not being racist here, I'm talking about the indigenous population, Aborigines have been there, but, you know, whites have never been there because it's simply too hot and an ordinary person couldn't last 20 minutes in the sort of heat that it generates, you know, within what they call the outback and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, look, we're not meteorologists. Now, the other day, Ms. Jones, I did a bit on TV about footballers and how rich they are and how much they contribute to society. And I was full of praise. You know, Marcus Rashford, who stimulated the school meals campaign, which made the government go into reverse and all that. And whilst I was full of praise for them and saying that, you know, they are very privileged people, they earn £200,000 a week, and these days they have a sense of noblesse oblige and want to use it for the greater good, I still don't want any government in this country, and I vote for politicians, right? I don't want those politicians dictated to by 19 or 20-year-old footballers.
I absolutely agree with you there. I mean, not only have these young guys not lived, but they generally haven't had that comprehensive an education. Mm. They focused on one thing for most of their lives.
Yeah.
And they tend to be a little bit stunted in other areas, which is not to say that they don't mature and they don't self-educate. Take somebody like David Beckham. You know, he's apart from a few blips, he's a fine, upstanding member of the global community.
Yes, exactly.
But I think it's the same thing with pop and rock idols, frankly, who, by and large, they're no role models, are they?
No.
But young people do need young people to identify with.
Of course they do.
So that's the paradox. Yeah. You know, these young people have had no life experience yet, so there's not a lot to look up to other than the fact that they're massively rich and famous.
Yes. No, I totally agree. And they did a poll on the show I was doing, saying, 88% of people think that footballers are better role models than politicians. Well, of course they are, because politicians are only liked by half the people in the country, you know, because they have a general election. It usually goes, you know, about 52-48 or something like that. So they are. But anyway, look, I tried to defend the footballers. I think the modern footballer is nothing like the footballer that your dad will have dealt with throughout most of his career. In fact, for instance, after the 96 defeat by Germany in the semi-final, your father would have been at Wembley for that one without doubt, Tony Adams took it so badly, it reconnected him to his alcoholic problem, which he'd kicked 3 months before. But he went on a 10-day bender after that game, and that led him to eventually having to go into a sanatorium to get treatment, and he's never had a drink since. So the modern footballer doesn't get there or do that. They're much more woke, and they want to spread their good luck. And I appreciate all that, but I don't think they should have the level of influence they have.
Do you know, you say about my dad covering football matches, but my dad was a footballer when I was...
Yeah, do you know, I didn't know that until I...
Yeah, he was a professional footballer. And my granddad and various uncles and so on. Yeah. So footballing was in the family blood, you know.
Sure.
But my dad earned £3 a week when he was at the height of his career, let's say. And it was ended very early. He was only 24 when he snapped his Achilles tendon. And in those days, there was no surgery for that. So that was it.
Who was he playing for?
Oh, at the end, I think he was with Hereford.
Oh, right.
But he'd been at Southend United, where his father had been a big star, and prior to that, Everton and so on. So, you know, they'd moved around. But it was a different game in those days. It was a hard job. If they had a match on Boxing Day somewhere in the country, to get there on a coach back then, you had to be travelling on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
So there were many times when those fathers were not at home with their families on Christmas Day.
To be honest, that still happens, because games on Boxing Day require training on Christmas Day. So the footballers are usually allowed sort of 4 hours with their family, and then they have to report for training. But, you know, they're told to eat a very light Christmas meal, no alcohol and all that kind of stuff. Actually, in your Father's Day, they used to play matches on Christmas Day, believe it or not. They used to open up the football grounds because there was nothing else around on Christmas Day. Anyway, there you go.
You can understand why my mother can't stand football, can't you?
Well, yeah, sometimes. I suppose sometimes football has such an influence on families. I mean, without a shadow of a doubt, when I grew up on Merseyside, and I was born and brought up in Chester, which is not Merseyside, it's Cheshire, and it's at the end of the Wirral. But, of course, we were always on Merseyside because we were always going to Everton. All my mates lived on the Wirral in places like Bromborough and things like that. But, no, what I was going to say was that the influence that football has on families is enormous. And some families, certainly in the city of Liverpool, took a conscious decision that football was more important than anything else, because a lot of people had miserable lives in those days. They didn't earn a lot of money. They lived in a little terraced house in a street of terraced houses. There wasn't enough, you know, money to enjoy any sort of lifestyle. So they put all their belief and their passion and their life into following their football team, Liverpool or Everton, and it became a way of life.
It's even more extreme in some countries, of course, like countries in South America.
Yes, you're right.
You know, where people like Ayrton Senna were gods.
Mm, mm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I've been to Buenos Aires, and I've seen the two clubs there. One is called Boca Juniors, and the other one is...
Oh, that's who Maradona played for.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
By the way, before millions of people call in, I do know that Ayrton Senna wasn't a footballer and that he was a Formula One driver.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm just making the point about sports idols
Ayrton Senna,
become people's lives.
Funny enough, Ayrton Senna was probably Brazil's biggest ever sporting hero, eclipsing Pelé. You're absolutely right to have named Ayrton Senna. When he died, the country went into national mourning for 5 days. It was... he died in a... I remember watching the Grand Prix. I was at my sister's in Bournemouth, and I've got a feeling it might have been the British Grand Prix, but I can't quite remember. But his wheel snapped off, bounced forward onto the bonnet of his car, and then hit him on the head and went over. That's the reason why Formula One racing cars these days have what's called the angel, which is a bracket that surrounds the driver's head. And none of the drivers wanted it. They said it would interfere with their vision. But it has already saved lives, and that's what killed Ayrton Senna. Ayrton Senna was enormous. You're absolutely right. He's like a god. But anyway, we move on. Now, guess what, Miss Jones? I went into a boots chemist yesterday, and I said, "Look, I'm very worried that my phone's going to ping, and I'm going to be told that, you know." I said, "I need to be able to test myself. How do I do it?" And the lady reached below the counter and came up with a box about the size of a paperback novel. Paperback.
I love that link. That was very clever.
Yeah, thank you. And handed me this box, and I got home and opened it, and there's, I think, 10 tests in there, which you can self-test. I didn't realise that was available. I said, "Oh, that's lovely, thank you. How much is this?" I thought it'd be about 10 quid or something. They're giving them away free for people to test. Have you been aware of that? Have you done it?
Oh, yeah. You can order them online as well, completely free, and they're delivered to your home the next day. It's very efficient service.
Yeah.
So we keep a constant supply of them so that we can carry on testing.
And do you keep testing yourself?
Every now and again, yes, just to make sure, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well done. So I didn't know. So anyway, look, hopefully all this will change imminently. As this podcast goes out, we have only, 48 hours until Freedom Day. But it's not looking that free at the moment, is it?
Well, no, and I'd already made the decision, as had other members of my family, to carry on wearing masks in things like restaurants, bars, on public transport, not in the street, because you're fairly safe out in the open air. But I think anywhere where people congregate and you are moving around, I think we still need to take that precaution. We probably will, for years, have to do that.
Yeah, I agree. But it's all about personal responsibility. If I got onto a crowded train, I'd wear my mask. If I got on, excuse me, onto a train that had like two other people in a long carriage, I wouldn't. You know what I mean? It's as simple as that. I will wear masks when I go into a Tesco Express. I'll wear masks when, excuse me, I go into Morrison's, all that kind of stuff. But I totally agree with you. They, you know, if people don't protect themselves, they're not protecting other people, and that's what it's all about. I'm going to self-isolate, you know, but I don't have to go to a pub every day to be able to get on with my life, okay? I mean, I do like going to the pub every day, of course I do, but I will definitely in future. I like drinking early sometimes because I've been brought up on a life of breakfast shows, you know. I worked on evening newspapers where you have to get in very early, and then Fleet Street, you always got in very early, and then in radio, always on breakfast shows. So I was normally around the office by about 4, 4:30. And when you finish at 10:30 or 11, you've cleared it, you've done 7 hours work. And so, you know, you would say this, wouldn't you? We always said, well, it's our lunch hour now. You know what I mean? You know, we've done a day's work. We can have a drink after work. So we'll start early. Now, I'm sorry about this rambling story, Miss Jones, but the pubs are empty between about 11 and 12:30 and 1. And that's my favourite time to be in a pub. I'd be very wary of going into a pub over lunchtime or certainly early evening after work without a mask on.
Oh, definitely. And I have noticed that the trains are much busier.
Yes.
I got on a train on Saturday. I was going to a wedding at St Bride's. And it was packed. I didn't know whether a previous train had been cancelled, and that was why it was much, much busier. But there weren't any places to sit, and all the seats were taken. So people weren't socially distancing, as in leaving spaces between the seats, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And the corridors were packed as well. I felt really quite threatened.
Golly.
In that situation.
Yeah, that is good. So your wedding at St Bride's, were you there as a church warden, of which you are an official of St Bride's Church, or were you there as a guest?
Yeah, I was on duty. It was one of our congregants whose daughter was getting married. I've known them both a long, long time. It was a beautiful wedding. It was very, quite Disney-like.
Yeah.
The bride walked in to Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty Overture, which most people will know from the Disney film version of Sleeping Beauty. And she was wearing a very pale pink and gold organza dress that seemed to go on forever. It was really beautiful and very uplifting after not having attended a wedding for such a long time.
Yeah, golly, that's great. And were guests allowed on either side? You know,
yeah, they had 60 guests, which was what they were allowed. And it went off beautifully. They even had confetti, which was made of real rose petals. Next morning when I turned up for Eucharist on Sunday morning, the petals had dried out and were just brushing away in the breeze with the leaves that had fallen.
How lovely. Where was the reception afterwards?
I don't know where they went because I wasn't a guest. As I say, I was on duty.
Right, so it wasn't local then?
No. There's not, as you know, there aren't very many venues.
There's that wine bar at the bottom of the lane there. It used to be called the Valley.
Oh, the Humble Grape, it's called nowadays.
And that's got like big rooms at the back, and I've seen a few receptions in there from weddings at St Bride's. But I totally agree. The last wedding I went to was the wedding of Joe Cole, the footballer, right? I was writing his book at the time, and it was at the hospital in Chelsea where the flower show takes place. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I've been there, yeah.
Have you? Yeah, there's a church there. There must be a church there because that...
Little chapel just inside.
Yeah, chapel, that's right. Yeah, so it's a chapel. But then, you know, they put up huge marquees for the reception afterwards. And I remember distinctly, I was sitting on one side, and on the other side, John Terry, who was then England captain, was sitting there with his wife. And I couldn't work out why he didn't have a jacket on. He had an immaculate suit on with a waistcoat and a shirt and a cravat or whatever it was. but he didn't have a jacket on. And years later, it was exactly the same style that Gareth Southgate adopted at the last World Cup. Remember, everybody praised Gareth for his waistcoat, but no jacket. And John Terry got there early. But it was a lovely wedding. And the great thing about Joe is a lovely boy, really, really decent man, you know. And he married his long-term girlfriend. And I think he's got four children now. He's certainly got three. And Joe went round to every table, and there must have been over 50 tables, honestly, I'm not joking. And he went round every table and said hello and posed for pictures and all that kind of stuff, which I thought was incredibly generous of him, you know, for his time.
I think you've got to do that. I remember at my father's funeral, same thing. We had an awful lot of people there. Mm. I at the reception afterwards, I did manage to get round every single table. And the reason I did it was because my mother couldn't do it. Mm. She is too elderly and too frail, and she couldn't face it, actually. It was very hard for her that day. Obviously, it was hard for everyone, but somebody had to do it. So I just kind of went gung-ho and did visit all the tables and said hello. Thanks to everyone for coming. I think that's really a courtesy. I think you've got to do it when you've invited people to a wedding or a funeral or christening or whatever it is.
Mm. My little sister got married. My father had just died, so I had to give her away, you know, which wasn't a chore at all. It was a pleasure. But I don't remember any table visiting afterwards, you know, and so maybe I'm not.
Had you had a few by then?
Well, I hadn't had a few. I was a very young man, you know, and you could tolerate quite a lot of drink when we were in our 20s, couldn't we, you know, and all that. No, it was nothing to do with that. It was that, you know, first of all, I had to, you know, perform all the duties of the father, so to speak, and then, you know, give a speech and all that kind of stuff and, you know, look after, you know, the bridegroom and all that kind of stuff. But I don't remember doing the table bit at all. Anyway, look, what do I know about? I've only ever been to about three weddings in my life. How many have you been?
Serious? No. Gosh, hundreds. I must have been to hundreds of weddings.
You're joking.
I've got so many boxes of photos, which are pictures of other people's weddings. Some of the people, I can't even remember who they are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's absolutely.
It's like babies, you know, people who send you a photo of their baby. All babies are beautiful. Yeah. I absolutely love and adore babies. Mm. But you look at these pictures years later and you think, who the hell's is that?
Yeah, no,
I don't even remember who that is.
I totally agree. I remember going to Joe Cole. I remember going to my sister's, obviously. Then my older sister got married 30 years after she shacked up with, you know, the bloke who became her husband, so to speak. They did it for tax reasons, in case one of them dies, you know, which is a bit maudlin, but you have to be practical about these things in life. And I think they're the only other wedding I went to was a chap who at the time was my best friend, because we met at the University of Trent where we were studying urban estate management, and he became a very successful estate agent, built a great business. I got out and moved into journalism. But he got married to a lady that I knew very well, and I naturally assumed that I would be the best man. Then about 2 weeks before the wedding, I thought I'd better give him a call about this, because obviously I'll have responsibilities. And he had to tell me over the phone that I wasn't best man. It was somebody that he employed at the estate agency he worked at, who he, you know, sort of developed a friendly relationship with. And I'm afraid our friendship, that is between myself and the bridegroom, never recovered. And we haven't spoken now for about 25 years.
Well, that's very odd to sack you without actually telling you that you were no longer best man.
Yeah, well, no longer best friend, because obviously it's usually your best friend who's the best man. But anyway, look, it's one of those things.
So you've never been to your own wedding, Mike?
Obviously, I've never been to my own wedding. I've never been a best man at a wedding. And proudly, I will say, I have never been on a stag night for anybody I know who's got married. My view of a stag night is it's the most repulsive form of gathering you can ever come across, because it's just a group of men showing off as to how drunk they can get and how excessive they can get. And I think it's a total insult to the bride that you feel you've got to go out and act like a caveman for one more night before you chain yourself to your bride for the rest of your life and have got to behave yourself. I think it's a
strong words, Mr. Parry.
No,
I tell you what's worse is a hen night on that kind of level,
right,
with gaggles of girls going off to, you know, shows by male strippers and that kind of thing. It's gross. Mm. But I tell you what it's like is a load of football fans turning up at Wembley for a match. Mm. It's the same kind of behaviour, excessive drinking and leering and shouting, and just there's something really horribly unpleasant about gaggles of mostly men, I will say, in that kind of situation.
No, I totally agree. I don't want to go back on the England defeat. Obviously, that's all come and gone now. But I've been sent some footage since we last spoke and in the week after the game. And it's video footage of England fans punching and fighting and kicking each other in the, you know, circular halls below the seats at Wembley Stadium. So the guys who are in there legitimately with tickets are trying to fight and keep out those who are barging through broken down doors to get in. It's horrendous. And what a terrible image it is for our country.
Awful. And will it have cost us the World Cup, do you think?
I think it must have done. Any football administrator, and let's face it, FIFA are not whiter than snow. FIFA have got all sorts of corruption problems, you know, and they're the ones who decide where the World Cups happen. But frankly, they can just produce that as evidence against us and say, how could you have a World Cup in that country? It's absolutely disgraceful, honestly. And it turned my stomach. I thought, my God, I thought all this had gone away. But I tell you what I put it down to, a basic stupid error. Why would you allow a game on a Sunday to kick off at 8 o'clock when the pubs open at 11? On that day, and I think I bored you with this story already, I was employed to do a Gogglebox version of the game, okay? So ITN, yeah. So they brought a camera around, put it behind the telly, and it was amazing, actually. So it's 4 hours, you know, from the half an hour before the game, all the game, extra time, penalties, and then stuff afterwards. And out of those 4 hours, they edited it down to about 45 seconds, you know, which they showed the following day on a number of TV shows. And it was great, you know, because it was one way of doing it. But I went to the pub on the Sunday morning at about 11 o'clock to see my local landlady and ask her what the response was and all that kind of stuff. And I had a couple of pints, so I was clear by about 1 o'clock. But there were people already by 1 o'clock when I left the pub who were leery. And I mean, you know, all the flag waving and the shouting had started. The game didn't kick off till 8 o'clock in the evening. Can you imagine what sort of state they would have been in by then? Why wasn't the game scheduled for 4 o'clock?
Well, not only that, but where are Wembley Stadium's administrators? Why are they letting people in who can barely stand?
Totally agree.
That's only going to end in tears.
Yeah, totally agree. Many, many years ago, the old Wembley, which your father would have known so well, I went to one cup final. I've been to about, I think, about 25 cup finals. But I went to this one and we had a reception in a hotel nearby and we walked up to the ground and some poor lad had come down on Friday night from somewhere like Birmingham. I think it might have been Aston Villa, Chelsea or something like that, you know. And his mates were carrying him to the turnstile. I mean, literally carrying him. He was so out of it. And then in the end, they wouldn't let him in. And they just had to leave him on the floor outside the turnstile. There was no hope for him. And, you know, it's just human behaviour, of course, to get excited about your team in the cup final. But I don't know. Who am I to say? What a waste that you never even got to see the game. Anyway.
Well, it's shameful. But, you know, we've all boarded aircraft, haven't we?
Yes.
Where there have been people in the queue who have been refused boarding because they're too drunk.
Yes.
And especially in the sky, it's far too dangerous to have people in that kind of state who could lose the plot at any minute and start lashing out.
Oh,
so I think the same rules need to apply to football stadia. They really do.
Too terrifying to contemplate, isn't it? Somebody going mad inside what you might call a metal tube in the air where there's nowhere to go if things go wrong. I totally agree. Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for being with us today, Life on Planet Porky. I have to say, Ms. Jones, we've had some marvellous feedback from our millions of listeners and followers lately. I'm particularly happy that people think that, you know, you've got the intelligent upper hand on me all the time. They don't really want to, do they, eh?
No, they really don't. I mean, look at the times. I know we're deprived at the moment. Look at the wondrous lunches and dinners we've had where we put the world to rights in very eloquent terms. And I don't think anybody could say there is a piece of paper between us in that term.
No, absolutely not. It'd be nice to get back to that.
And, oh, we will. We'll do it soon.
Well, you know, let's hope so. Talking about business, And I didn't know the guy very well, and I didn't meet him. But a chap called Jono Coleman has sadly passed away.
Oh, Jono, yeah, that was sad to hear, wasn't it?
65 years of age. Mm. So I've beaten him by 1 year so far. So I keep my fingers crossed for that. You know, I never came across him. But, you know, in our business, and I'm talking about the media business, I'm talking about you in newspapers, writing books and all that, you just have to keep, you know, chipping away and chipping away and chipping away, and there's always going to be times when you fall down and you've got to get back up again and get back onto the horse and keep riding. People will try and do you down and you've got to try and fight back. You know, you and I have had decades of this, okay? But Jono was very, very successful because, and it's an amazing story. I work with Chris Evans now in the sense that I work in the same building. I have a drink with Chris sometimes after the show. Chris is a very wealthy man because he made a brilliant business decision to buy Virgin, and I think it was only 3 years later he sold it for three times what he bought it for when there was a media frenzy in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. But when he bought it, this chap, Jono Coleman, who seems like a really nice guy, nice personality, was doing the breakfast show. Chris wanted the breakfast show, so he took that for himself, moved Jono on to Drive. Jono went to Australia, where he grew up from the age of eight, to see his parents, and found out through a message sent to him that he'd lost his show, but he bounced back and got onto Heart. I mean, it's a very interesting story about our business.
And we are surrounded by stories like that all the time, aren't we?
Yes.
It's cutthroat. Look at the times when women have gone on maternity leave, yeah, and have tried to return to their old job only to find it no longer exists.
Yes.
You've experienced that myself at the Daily Mail, actually. Yeah. And They just sort of wiped out the position, so there was no job for me there. But the next call I got a couple of days later was from Nick Gordon, who had been one of the associate editors on the Daily Mail, was now editing You magazine, yeah, in the days when it was more of a Sunday Times magazine rather than lipstick and tights, as it tends to be today.
Yeah.
And he said, what are you doing? I said, nothing. He said, come in and see me. Mm. I said, well, I can't really. I've got a newborn baby. It's all a bit difficult. He said, I've got four kids. Bring her in. Doesn't make any difference to me.
Yeah.
And so I did that, went in to see him. He offered me a job on the spot. And I then worked for him for the next 5 years, touring the world with a baby under, or child under one arm. I only came back to UK full time when she was five and she had to go to school full time.
Yeah, golly, absolutely.
So I had a great run thanks to him. So, you know, for every fall through the floor, there's somebody waiting in the wings to pick you back up. You just have to, you have to be lucky and you have to believe.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Listen to this for a bit of bad luck. Jonathan Coleman, Australian, he was co-host of the Ross and Jono show on Virgin Radio, okay? One of their regular targets for taking the mickey and a bit of abuse, the most frequent target of scorn, was Chris Evans, who they accused of having failing ratings over at the BBC, okay? And they never missed a chance to make fun of it. In 1996, they beat him to the Sony Award for Best Breakfast Show, and Coleman took the opportunity to berate Evans in an open letter published in the Daily Mirror, accusing him of becoming unbelievably self-indulgent and plugging too many hotels and airlines. The problem was that Chris Evans was in the had brought the plan together to buy Virgin. So I'm afraid it didn't look good for Jono when Chris Evans suddenly turned up, literally walked to the door and said, "Hi, I'm the new boss." That sort of moment sends a shiver down your spine, doesn't it?
Well, there is a personal vendetta.
Yes,
that was building for years. And yeah, Chris Evans was determined that revenge was going to be a dish best eaten cold.
Yeah.
So he would go right to the top and cut those guys out from under their own legs, yeah, and buy the station and then fire them.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't we all want to do something like that?
Yeah, but actually it was even more, painful. Because although Jono got the boot, the guy he worked with, who was it Russ Williams? I think it was. Yeah, Russ Williams was allowed to continue the show on his own. And that, of course, meant that Russ Williams and Jono Coleman then, you know, rifted for the rest of their life. It's terribly sad, but that's the sort of thing that happens in our profession. You're absolutely right. Everybody wants the top show. Everybody wants number one position. And we fight, you know, tooth and nail for it, but there we are. What do you think about the fact that Tom Cruise, who, you know, is apparently over here making a film, he turns up at Wimbledon. He turns up at the England games, the semi-final and the final. He's all over, you know, the Royals and all that. I mean, is this a bit of, you know, a bit showboating? Or do we say, well, he's working in this country and he's shown a great respect for our institutions?
I was beginning to think at one point there might be more than one Tom Cruise because he was popping up all over the place, wasn't he? Almost like one of those gags.
Three-piece suit, yes.
Yeah, it was very strange. I mean, there are lots of good stories about Tom Cruise, most of which we can't tell.
No,
on
I totally
air.
Agree.
But some of the milder things over the years, the fact that he auditioned girlfriends, the fact that the Church of Scientology, which I think he's fallen out with now, that they set up his first date with his third wife, Katie Holmes.
Yeah. Is that when he jumped up and down on the couch on Oprah's show and said, "I love Katie," or something? They made a complaint.
Yes, yeah, that was the one. They're divorced now, of course. He uses tricks, doesn't he, to appear taller than he really is in his films. Things like shoe lifts, and he stands on a box. That's My mother said that Alan Ladd used to do that as well.
They used to make opposite to Alan Ladd, they used to make him stand in a hole. A ditch.
Oh, in a ditch, yeah. But you can't really do that in Wembley Stadium or at Wimbledon, can you? So your secret is blown, let's say. I've never found him that appealing. I think the only film I really liked him in was Rain Man. And I think he really did demonstrate very fine acting ability in that film. But
I think he's got good acting ability. The only film I've ever seen him in, which I'd watch again, and I have watched it several times, is Top Gun. I thought it was a magnificent film, honest to God. And the thing is, when I've looked back over his career and all that, he did Top Gun when he wasn't Tom Cruise. Do you understand what I'm saying? He was this new actor who suddenly got a break and, you know, do you want to be in this show about, like, fighter pilots and all that? Yeah, OK. But the minute he became Tom Cruise, if you see what I mean, I think his demeanour and his attitude to life changed.
Yeah, it seems very much that way, doesn't it? That he believed his own publicity and everything went to his head. I tell you who else is like that.
Yeah.
Richard Gere, or Richard's Gere, as he was known on Fleet Street. Well, a very odd person who just thought that he walked on water and treated journalists abominably.
Oh, you've told the story on this podcast.
Yeah, I have.
About how he, you know, literally derided you in an interview, and you ask him a question, then he asks you, why have you asked that question? Oh, come on, you know.
Oh, and much like Chris Evans, I got my own back royally in print.
Good. What did you do?
Well, I just wrote it all.
Yeah, but
exactly what he did.
Didn't they refuse to print it?
Well, they did. I got it printed in a magazine event.
Excellent.
It was because the first line offended the editor.
Yeah.
It was about the most genuine thing about Richard Gere is his Rolex.
Yeah.
And the features editor said, we can't say that in the paper. Why not? Because the editor wears a fake Rolex. How do you know? Mm. Oh, I was with him in Hong Kong when he paid $30 for it in the market.
Mm. I used to buy those fake watches, you know, in New York. On almost every corner in New York, there'd be a bloke. Literally, you know, they used to make a joke about a man who sold matches from a tray on the corner of streets in New York. They used to sell these fake watches. I had every watch brand in the world, you know, Rolex, you know, what's the one with the three stripes, the fashion brand?
The Gucci ones.
Gucci, all that kind of stuff.
So you were the one funding terrorism in New York then?
I was, but I didn't know I was funding terrorism. Mm. But watches only ever lasted about like 3 weeks before they fell to pieces.
As long as that. About 3 minutes.
Yeah.
By the time you reach the following block, they've already collapsed.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And I made the mistake once, you know, of taking a fake Rolex into a jeweller's and asking them to shrink the bracelet, you know, because it was too big for my wrist, and they nearly rang the police. I'm not joking.
I'm surprised.
You know, we wouldn't deal with this trash. How dare you come in here? We're a respectable jewelers. We wouldn't handle all this kind of stuff. And I said, all right, I was only asking, you know. But anyway.
It's like the counterfeit handbags.
Yeah,
you know, there was a time when everybody was walking around with a fake Chanel bag. I didn't have one, by the way, but I can name you a few people who did.
Yeah.
But nowadays, even if people try to order a counterfeit handbag online from some supplier in the Far East, the police come down on them like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Why did I read a piece in a very respectable magazine called Spectator? Butt of the joke, streaking is now a great British tradition. I mean, how can you figure that out?
I think it's probably because we've had quite a few famous incidences of streaking, and everyone remembers Erica Rowe at Twickenham in, what was it, rugby union match in 1982?
Well, I don't know, it was 82, but it was definitely an England game, yeah.
And the streaker, yeah.
Policeman had to take his helmet off and cover her very large breasts with his helmet, yeah.
There was another one, wasn't there? A guy and a policeman similarly took off his helmet and held it in front of the guy's groin so that we didn't see his meat and two veg. Yeah. But I mean, look, it's drunken dares, isn't it, usually? Bit of tomfoolery. It's usually at the football, the rugby or the cricket.
Yeah.
We don't tend to arrest these people, I don't think.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a criminal offence in other countries. Maybe it is something peculiarly British.
Well, maybe it is, but I think it's disgusting and I hate it.
Do you really? I don't. I think it's just a bit of fun, isn't it, really?
Flaunting nakedness like that is great. Let me read you the start of this piece. One evening, this is written by a lady called Poppy Boyds. One evening, a few summers ago, I convinced a friend to run with me up Portobello Road. Portobello Road. Somebody wrote a song about that. And we were completely naked. As we reached the finish line, we could hear the sirens. We were accosted by two policemen. I was convinced they would throw us in the slammer. Instead, the officers, she must be American, this lady. We don't call it the slammer, do we, in this country?
But Notting Hill, Portobello Road?
Yeah, well, maybe. Instead, the officers gently told us that it would be wise to put our clothes back on. One of them, having seen my body gleaming in the pale moonlight, suggested I should really consider getting a tan. So it's all joking.
Oh, dear. No.
Funny you should talk about Erica Rowe, because a mutual friend of ours, Mr. Roger Taverner, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we went to Portsmouth to watch a football match from London. And in those days, the A3 now goes straight through from where I live here in Stockbroker Vale, Surrey, straight to Portsmouth, you know, and the M27, and then I go down there to Gosport and my place and all that kind of stuff. But in those days, the A3 stopped at roundabout Guildford, and for the rest of the it was still the A3, but it was just a road. It wasn't a motorway like it is now. You know what I mean? So we actually had to weave our way down after Guildford through all these little towns towards the coast. I'm not sure why Rog came with me, because Roger supported Luton. And we did, on a famous occasion, go to Birmingham for the semi-final of the FA Cup when Everton beat Luton 2-1. And we had a hell of a weekend, believe me, in a hotel in Birmingham. So I'm not sure why Rog came with me to Portsmouth. I think it was just that, you know, I was going and he said, yeah, I'll come along. But we stopped at a pub in a small town on the way down. It might have been Waterlooville or somewhere like that. You know what I mean? It was probably 20 miles from Portsmouth. Best stop here and have a drink. We walked in and we both at the same time realised that the lady serving the drinks, who had, you know, a very profound bosom, was actually Erica Rowe.
Serious? Did she have the bosom out?
Well, she had the expression we use is the fruit was on the barrow, you know.
Oh, right. Okay. So she was wearing a very low-cut blouse.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Exactly. But, I mean, it was so, you know, of the moment we thought, hang on, how could this be happening? And of course, we were two journalists. But in those days, you didn't carry phone cameras. So, you know, we had to ring up, you know, from a phone box, ring the picture desk, you know, get to send somebody down. We weren't there when the snappers arrived, you know, because she hadn't been seen, you know, for months or years or something like that. And all of a sudden, here she was, Erica Rowe, humbly working as a barmaid again, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
So did you file a story before you made your excuses and left?
No, because we didn't know if they were going to get down to get a picture of her. And remember, that was Saturday at about 12 o'clock. And of course, we didn't have to file until the following day, Sunday, for Monday. See what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
But we called in on the way back, of course, and the pictures had been taken. So we wrote the story on Sunday morning. But
and was she friendly about it? Did she want to be exposed?
Oh, yeah. She was lovely, lovely, you know. And you know, we told her who we were. She said, oh, that's lovely. You know, she said, people used to come and see me all the time, every day, you know, after it happened and all that. And then interest sort of petered off. But Roger and I found a line somewhere about, you know, she's getting married or something like that, you know what I mean? And brought her back to prominence. Talking about famous people, by the way, it's the, as we speak, actually, it's the 37th birthday of Gareth Gates. Now, has Gareth ever been any good, or is he just a myth?
He was runner-up in the first series of Pop Idol.
Oh, yes.
Which would have been 2002.
Right.
He sold millions of records. I think he was quite well known because he had a stutter.
Yes, that's right.
And very interestingly, today, or he has certainly done this in the recent past, he became a speech coach for this program to try and cure stuttering. I don't know whether it worked.
Really?
But I remember reading a story about that. I think I know him more as a musical theatre star because he's been in things like Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He's been in Les Mis, Legally Blonde, things like that.
Yeah.
But I remember that his first single was Unchained Melody, which kind of, it was number one, but everybody's had a number one with that, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing. Oh, I didn't know that. And he's still going strong, is he?
Not to my knowledge, but I mean, nobody's been in musical theatre for a year and a half now anyway, have they?
No.
So he'll probably make a big comeback. He was very popular, remember that?
Yeah, I think he was. Now, Ms. Jones, I'm going to take you to task on some dietary issues, okay?
Oh, no, okay. Here we go.
So I've read the report, I think it was either this morning or yesterday, saying that all these fake milks, including the soy milk that you drink, are actually...
I don't drink soy milk.
Oh, what do you drink?
I drink oat milk.
Oat milk. Well, that's just as bad, apparently, according to...
No, it isn't. Absolutely not.
No? Well, anyway, the report that I've read, okay, and I read all these reports all the time, says that the only good milk is cow's milk, which you constantly... attack and say, you know, cow's milk is made for cows, it's not made for humans.
Well it is. Report, it is not made anyway.
It's top food scientist, it says cow's milk is good milk.
Yeah, well, I disagree. Cow's milk is produced by cows for their baby calves. It was never intended for humans to drink.
Really?
Or consume or make into other things. Mm. I don't want to drink cow's milk. I don't eat any dairy products. And I prefer to drink oat milk. I only have a little bit anyway in a couple of cups of tea each day. I'm not a cereal eater. I don't cook with it very much. I might make the odd lasagna, but my lasagnas are always vegan. So I don't use any animal products in those at all.
Okay.
But it's a matter of choice. It's personal choice. I'm not political about it. Yeah. I just don't want to have dairy products.
Okay. So I'll read you the opener to this deeply researched scientific paper that I've come across, Miss Jones. You know, I do my research.
Sitting comfortably,
yes. And it says, Mother Nature has gifted us few more complete foods than milk, full of protein, calcium and good fats essential for cognitive development and health. It's among the most nutrient-dense comestibles. Sorry, I haven't come across that word before. Comestibles out there. Dairy is also threaded through our culture and heritage. It forms a backdrop to some of our literary classics, such as the work of the novelist Thomas Hardy. The sight of cows grazing in lush... grazing.
Grazing? Well, they dig their own graves now.
Grazing in lush green fields is quintessentially British. But you won't accept it, will you?
I mean, cows exist. People drink cow's milk. People have cheese, all that. Yeah, very good. It's fine for them. It's not fine for me. I choose not to eat dairy for various medical reasons. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with me. So some people might disagree, but there you are.
Now, the second report I've got here, put you on the spot again, Miss Jones, is that salt actually is not harmful to the body in large quantities, doesn't give you strokes, doesn't filter your blood, and you should eat salt because we all need salt. That's another scientific report. Now,
well, this is very dangerous. I will take issue with this. Because, yes, salt is an important nutrient for the body. It's a natural resource, but too much is still a heart killer. So we should be having no more than 5 grams a day. I don't know if you know that, which is less than 1 teaspoon. Most of us are consuming about 9 grams a day without putting any salt on anything at all because it's in everything we eat naturally. It occurs naturally. It's also added.
I agree. It's in things like bread. It's in things like cornflakes. I totally agree.
It's in everything, as is sugar. Mm. So you are consuming, without even trying, about 9 grams a day. Mm. So the last thing you want to do, which I know you're very fond of doing, is shaking salt in addition over your food before you eat it.
Yeah.
You are killing yourself.
Yeah, but you say that, but this, honestly, I'm not joking. This latest report says it's all a scare story. And do you know what? I've been eating huge quantities of salt for, oh, golly. I've just seen, sorry, as I'm looking at you, I'm staring out to my roof garden and a gust of wind suddenly blew my door back and bashed it because I forgot to put the latch on it. Anyway, not to worry. I'll hope it's not damaged. Sorry about that.
We digress, folks.
Yeah, we digress. Yeah.
We generally do, yes. Yeah.
So anyway, what I was going to say is I have been eating large amounts of salt for years. So, for instance, even as a kid, I would always put salt on my sausage butty that my mum made me. I would always put loads of salt on my fish and chips. I put salt on everything, and I still do to this day. So I would say that I've probably been eating good quantities, large quantities of salt for 50 years, and it hasn't damaged me. It hasn't hurt me.
Oh, hang on. What about your heart? What's your blood pressure like? What about your kidneys? What about fluid retention?
No, osteoporosis?
Are you sure? Have you had an MOT lately?
I have. I have one every 6 months to make sure. One of the problems I've got is that I still take 16 tablets a day to keep the heart going. Now, that eventually will wear down my kidneys because, you know, they have to process all the ingredients in it. But so far, so good. You know, they're still in as good a shape as a man of my age should have kidneys in shape, if you see what I mean. But I've never, ever had a report come back from all the blood tests that I take regularly saying you've got, you know, you're oversalted or something like that. And I just love salt. I can't bear life without salt. So the other day, for instance, I thought I need something to snack on. You know, I'm losing energy. So I go to my freezer and I get out a bag of McCain skinny chips, which I love, frozen, obviously, you know. And I put them in the oven for about 5 minutes. That's all you need to do. And they come out and they're lovely. You know, they're fizzing and bubbling, you know. And then I douse them in salt whilst they're still sort of, you know, got the moisture of the grease in them. And honestly, it to me, it's the most delightful snack in the world, a bowl of chips, you know. But I put salt in everything and it's never hurt me.
I think that these kinds of reports are very worrying because it's misleading to people who want to hear that what they're doing to themselves is not harmful. Yeah. So I would be very careful if I were you. I would cut back on your salt consumption a little bit.
Well, you may well be right, and I might well take your advice. Let's end on a high note. Which way up do you eat your chocolate biscuits, Miss Jones? Because
do you mean? Do I eat them standing up or lying
down?
Yes,
that's right. You stand on your head when you eat your chocolate biscuits. Because
not exactly. No.
No. Honestly, this report, and I can see, you know, the true common sense of it is that most of us eat a chocolate biscuit with the chocolate on the top, don't we? And you crunch your teeth, and then you look at the chocolate as it goes into your mouth, and that's great. But of course, scientists say they're completely wrong. Turn it upside down, because the true value of a chocolate biscuit is the chocolate touching the sensory parts of your mouth, which are all located in your tongue. So, you know, you should put it in upside down so the chocolate gets onto your tongue right away for an instant hit.
What I tend to do, if I very rarely have a chocolate biscuit, but usually I go around to my mother's and have a biscuit because I don't buy biscuits.
Right.
If I buy biscuits, I'll eat the whole packet at one sitting. So I can't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I only eat them at my mum's. But I will dip a chocolate biscuit into my cup of tea.
I'll be
distracted by something my mum is saying, and that I'll leave it in the cup too long.
Yeah.
Then it disintegrates into the tea.
Disgusting.
And I end up drinking the chocolate biscuit instead of eating it.
Oh, no. Our listeners didn't want to hear that, Miss Jones.
Oh, yeah, I bet they do it as well.
Well, they might, but it's not something we talk about on the slot.
I bet producer Sam does that.
So, listen, in the Parry Penthouse, we do not talk about those.
Dunking. Yeah. It's a bit uncouth for you, is it?
Disgusting.
Oh, suddenly we've come over all posh, have we?
Oh, blimey. It's not for me.
Even right. Royalty dunk their biscuits, I'll have them.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's up to royalty, you know, but I don't.
I tell you what's a really nice biscuit to dunk into a cup of tea. You should really try this.
Yes.
Garibaldi biscuits.
Garibaldi.
Ugh. And then you can suck all the currants out.
Oh, it gets worse. God, it's like the only person who should do that is somebody who's lost all their teeth, but otherwise it's completely unacceptable. Right, okay. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. To all our listeners and followers, thank you indeed for having joined us. And we'll be back with you again very soon. And remember, folks, the heat is on. So I'm not sure why Rog came with me to Portsmouth. I think it was just that, you know, I was going, and he said, yeah, I'll come along. But we stopped at a pub in a small town on the way down. It might have been Waterlooville or somewhere like that, you know what I mean? It was probably 20 miles from Portsmouth. Best stop here and have a drink. We walked in, and we both at the same time realised that the lady serving the drinks, who had, you know, a very profound bosom, was actually Erica Rowe.
Serious? Did she have the bosom out?
Well, she had the expression we use is the fruit was on the barrow, you know what I mean?
Oh, okay. So she was wearing a very low-cut blouse.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Exactly. But, I mean, it was so, you know, of the moment we thought, hang on, how could this be happening?
If I buy biscuits, I'll eat the whole packet.
Yeah, I'm
at one sitting, so yeah, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. So I only eat them at my mum's. But I will dip a chocolate biscuit into my cup of tea.
I'll be
distracted by something my mum is saying, and that I'll leave it in the cup too long. Yeah. Then it disintegrates into the tea,
disgusting.
And I end up drinking the chocolate biscuit instead of eating it.
Oh, no. Our listeners didn't want to hear that, Joan.
Oh, yeah, I bet they do it as well.
Well, they might, but it's not something we talk about on this log. I think it's a total insult to the bride that you feel you've got to go out and act like a caveman for one more night before you chain yourself to your bride for the rest of your life and have got to behave yourself.